When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain, and once more I'm at Shea Hart, where I've joined Peter Hart in his salubrious lounge.
Lounge. There's a loony in it now. So what's today's episode? Well, it's episode 2 of our new series, Air War over the Somme. And this is called an aerial offensive. Now, let's pose you a question. Gary, you're feeling intellectual today. You told me before we started that you'd felt one or two brain cells firing up. When did the air offensive start? Did that start with the infantry offensive on the 1st of July?
No, of course not. What sort of question is that?
When did it start?
Well, the aerial offensive, it had to commence well before the first British guns had begun their preliminary bombardment. So some weeks, if not months.
Months, I think we'd go for, yeah. So what are they up to? What do they have to do? We've talked about it endlessly, but let's quickly go through it again.
Artillery observation was required to identify and register the thousands of possible targets.
Yeah, that's
meanwhile,
true.
The Germans had to be prevented from observing the British preparations and, if possible, driven from the sky.
Now, to maximise the effect of any bombardment, you've got to identify your targets, which means photographic reconnaissance. They've got to photograph every square inch of the ground and the immediate hinterland. On a daily basis, don't they?
Yeah, and that was to meticulously chart and interpret any changes. Thousands upon thousands and upon thousands of photographs were taken. And this is Lieutenant Robin Rowell of 12 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps. And you're going to tell us what he said.
As far as possible, the whole of the German front line would be photographed for a depth of about 1,000 yards every month. The cameras that we used for this box were box cameras with an infinity focus containing an auxiliary magazine or changing box of 12 plates. As each of these plates was exposed, they were transferred into a second changing box by means of a sliding handle that worked on top of the camera. This handle reset the shutter for another exposure at the same time. The shutter release had a piece of cord attached to it so that the pilot might pull it easily with his thick, gloved hands.
However, things could quite easily go wrong.
Yeah, I could see that. But the overlapping results would be put together and linked together to form a photographic map, a sort of mosaic, wouldn't it be, Gary?
Yeah, of the particular sector of the front that they were interested in. And once more, you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Robin Rowell of 12 Squadron says.
Slavery, that's what this is. Now, the advantage of fixing the camera to the machine is that the pilot can only take photographs of objects directly below him. And in consequence, his pictures are all small maps of the ground with a correct perspective and can be pieced together to form a large photo of the enemy's trenches and emplacements. One cannot underestimate the value of good results. In a good photo, taken from a reasonable height, say 6,000 to 8,000 feet, and enlarged from a quarter plate to a half plate, it is wonderful what you can see. You can count railway trucks and engines in sidings. From their positions, you can frequently tell whether they're empty or full. You can distinguish between main lines, temporary light railways, roads, cart tracks, footpaths. If you march half a dozen men across a field in a single file, their tracks can be picked up with a magnifying glass. The gunners spend half their lives trying to hide their guns or camouflage their battery positions, and it frequently deceives the casual glance of an observer. But if once you get a photograph of the field that they are in, you will, even in all probability, see the muzzle of their guns, to say nothing of the limber tracks along the hedges. If you made a trench and enforced it with barbed wire, you will not only be able to see if it's a deep trench by the shadows or if it has water in it, but you will be able to see how many rows of barbed wire entanglement it has in front of it. And which way the field was last ploughed. I think he's doing that for comic effect. It wasn't that funny. I'm not sure the RFC are funny. They think they are.
Now, Rowell was not exaggerating the potential of aerial photography, and even by that stage, the methods of interpreting aerial photographs had advanced considerably.
Now, to your eye, untrained as it would be, Gary, an aerial photograph would reveal remarkably little. But what to an expert? I was going to say like me, but then I realised that none of the listeners...
And you've only got one eye.
Yeah, I've only got one eye, so I don't see in stereo. That's just bollocks. But let's carry on. To an expert like Trevor Henshaw, our good friend, what could they see?
Well, in conjunction with the associated features, they could determine the probable nature and purpose of an object by analysing aspects of the shape, size, shadow structure and tone.
It is quite difficult, but they could do it. And characteristic features would expose the inner workings of the German defences. That, well, what are we talking about? Give us some examples of what I mean.
Well, some of the obvious things, such as machine gun posts.
Important, I would say, wouldn't you?
Trench mortar batteries.
Important.
Gun batteries.
Very important.
Dugouts.
Yeah.
And mineshafts.
Yeah, that could be important if the Germans are planning to blow you up.
The configuration of tracks and buried cables allowed the location of the various headquarters to be determined.
Yeah, that's true.
However, this expertise took time to codify, and photographic interpretation was by no means an exact science in 1916.
So they're not picking up as much as they would later in the war.
No.
Now, thousands of guns.
Guns? Where do guns go?
They're like scones, only bangy. Thousands of guns have moved into the Somme area. So the artillery observation aircraft, they've got a ceaseless task, and they're seeking out the location of German gun positions. That is crucial, those bloody 5.9s, the rest of the German artillery, because there's going to be a duel between the artillery when the offensive comes. And this is what Lieutenant Alan Jackson of 5 Squadron Royal Flying Corps says.
You went up for about an hour and a half, with the object of spotting enemy guns firing. You looked out across the lines into enemy territory, and if a gun was operating, you'd see a flash, and then white smoke would be visible. You'd realise then that there was an enemy battery. And on the large-scale map you were carrying, you'd make a note of the exact position. During the period of that reconnaissance, you might discover 2 or 3 batteries, and you did the same thing for each case. There were occasions on which you reported them straight away, back to one of your own batteries, which were on the alert with the object of taking on any new battery, but generally speaking, on an artillery reconnaissance, you made a note and then brought the intelligence back to your office. Telephone up the batteries concerned and let them know what the situation was, or go down and see the battery commanders and let them know exactly where these batteries were so that they could take them on when they wanted to.
Now, like most things, the real methodology had developed on aerial observation. That's what the Army's like. That's what the Air Force became like. It's well established by this time. It's become a matter of routine, hasn't it? And this is what Lieutenant Robin Rowell of 12 Squadron, or Rowell, Rowell, he said this. Now, arranging a gun from an airplane is the most perfect way that it is possible to devise, and it naturally achieved extraordinary success. The rough principle of the game is this. Each aeroplane has a transmitting set of different note or frequency. Why didn't they have a transmitting and a receiving set, Gary?
Wait. Yeah. We talked about that in the first one.
Of course we did. Just reminding our punters, as we call them. Each battery of any consequence will have a receiving instrument, operators and code letters by which it is known, and can always be called upon to fire. In ordinary quiet times, the targets that have been arranged are pre-arranged before the machine leaves the ground. When the machine gets up over the lines, it will first go over and have a good look at the target. The observer will make a mental note of the distances of various objects around that target so that he will have something by which to judge his distances. He will also take note with what is due north and set his imaginary clock dial with 12 o'clock pointing north. The machine then returns to the battery and warns them to prepare for their first round. What's he on about, clock?
Well, he's on about the clock code.
We mentioned that last week.
We did, which had been developed in 1915, and it allowed the aerial observer to communicate within the same frames of reference with the battery on the ground.
Is there a problem that could develop here? I could think of one that would happen given the nature of the Royal Artillery and the nature of the Royal Flying Corps.
Well, I think what you mean is that the Royal Artillery was a proud and august regiment, and it harboured within it many traditionally minded officers who didn't take too kindly to being given fire orders by rank outsiders.
And juniors.
And this is what Lieutenant Thomas Hughes of 1 Squadron Royal Flying Corps says. The real crux of the matter is that the artillery have a profound distrust and contempt for the Royal Flying Corps and have a terror of allowing their guns to be run by the Flying Corps. This is the phrase which is always produced in such controversies. As a matter of fact, there are many cases when the Flying Corps are the only people who can run the artillery. And if they're not even allowed to have priority in the use of one gun, they are practically wasted. The artillery are apt to exaggerate their accuracy when firing without aerial observation. I think both sides lost their tempers.
I do love Thomas Hughes. He does end up dead, but he's a most miserable bugger. And he's always got these. I love it when people give their characters away. And he's quite acerbic, isn't he? You wouldn't know what that meant. But
I thought he was English.
That's fun.
Now, the German anti-aircraft fire, generally nicknamed
Archie, not that old one again.
After a popular music hall song, plagued both the artillery observation and photographic reconnaissance missions. They were required by the nature of their duties to fly at a comparatively low altitude of around 6,000 feet in the case of aerial photography reconnaissance.
How many of them? That's like McManaman, his name never ends.
And once more, you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Robin Rowell of 12 Squadron says.
Anti-aircraft gun Archie became extremely accurate with practice, and as it was almost essential to fly at a straight course when photographing, the gun has had plenty of time to make the sky thick with bursting shell. In some parts of the line, it was perfectly amazing to see the amount of stuff they could chuck up at you in a minute. The shells would burst far faster than you could count them, and you were compelled to change your direction every 15 or 20 seconds, or you would not last long. But it's well worth taking the risks, the heavy risks, to get good photos. And of course he is. There is a slight exaggeration. I don't think it was like flak over Germany in 1943, 45. But it all depends on what you're used to. So to him,
It's all relative.
The sky's full of bursting shells. The fact it wasn't that much, he wouldn't know what's coming 40 or 30, 20 years down.
Now, when they sighted their opposite numbers in German reconnaissance aircraft, they would inevitably try to bring them down.
Now, before we introduce the next quote, I'd like to tell you a little tale about this gentleman. This gentleman is Captain Archibald James of 2 Squadron. And when I first went to the War Museum, my boss was a slightly pompous but lovable gentleman called David Lance. And he was, of course, I thought he was a pompous bastard, but, you know, he'd met his match with Archibald James, who took pomposity to a whole new level. Like, and it was unbelievable how pompous he was. And he wrote a letter. He didn't get on with David at all. And he took offence at David's being a plebeian commoner and all the rest of it. And he wrote a letter referring to the idiot with the tape recorder, which he sent to David's secretary, Paddy, who I well remember. This was, of course, a confidential letter, and it was amazing how it somehow ended up on the War Museum main notice board for staff, where we laughed merrily at it. But there's one thing that came to my mind. that one day I wanted to be the idiot with a tape recorder. I wanted to be that idiot.
And indeed you were, and you remained an idiot for some 40 years.
Yeah, and some people say I still am.
And you've got a tape recorder.
I have. It's there. We're recording this now. Anyway, so I want, when you're listening to this, I want you to get the idea of suppressed fury and impatience that only the truly pompous idiot can have. You must have had bosses like that at Transport for
Life. No, but some people who worked for me did.
You were never pompous, Gary.
And this is Captain Archibald James of 2 Squadron.
One day, I was arranging a battery and I was on our side of the lines. Oh, you know I said I was an idiot?
Yes.
It's you.
Yes. One day, I was arranging a battery and I was on our side of the lines over our battery, the visibility being very good. I looked over the side before sending the signal to our battery to fire, and to my surprise saw a German two-seater almost directly below me, well on our side of the lines, and about 1,000 foot below. I had in the front seat of the BE-2C as my observer and air gunner a corporal in my squadron who hadn't much experience in the air. So I throttled back, shouted to him what was happening, showed him the aeroplane and said, "Get your Lewis gun!" I omitted to say, "Don't start shooting till I tell you to." With that, I proceeded to go down, circling on top of the all unsuspecting German. Unfortunately, my corporal got excited, and when we were at least 150 yards away, he opened fire and discharged the whole drum of his Lewis gun without any effect at all. Indeed, the range was excessive. I then flattened out very, very close echeloned above the German. And I shall never forget the look of horrified surprise on the Germans' faces when they looked up, alerted by the rattle of my machine gun, and looked at me in sort of open-mouthed astonishment. The German observer recovered his composure in probably 2 or 3 seconds and swung round the rotating mounting round his cockpit and pointed the gun at me and opened fire. Meanwhile, my idiot corporal was fumbling to try and get another drum on. We were so close that I actually saw the oil burning off the recoiling portions of the German machine gun. Well, naturally, after 2 or 3 shots had been fired, I banked steeply away at the same moment as the German banked in the same direction. And we almighty nearly collided. That was the end of a thoroughly unsatisfactory episode.
Wonderful.
So you were the idiot with the tape recorder and I was an idiot corporal.
You were an idiot corporal. Yeah. It's funny how that one story unites both of our past careers.
Now, the BE-2C was generally inferior to the German two-seater LVG and Albatross reconnaissance machines.
What does LVG stand for?
Oh, I can't remember. But the natural...
Talking high.
But the natural disparities of competence meant that a good British crew at least had a fair chance if they happened to meet a bad German crew.
Yeah, but the LVGs are a very different kettle of fish, aren't they, from the threat of the Fokkers that still loomed over the BE-2C squadrons.
I think the LVGs is named after the factory.
It is, but I can't remember what it's called.
No, it's a German factory.
Yes, it's got a German name, hasn't it?
Although the casualties were not numerically high in comparison with the infantry, they still hit hard in the small world of the squadron mess, where every loss was a personal blow. And you are going to tell us, not me, you are going to tell us what Lieutenant Alan Dorr of 13 Squadron says.
News arrives that old Wright and Lucas are down behind the lines, but within reach of shells, both wounded in a fight with a Fokker. Powell and I go off to see the machine. It had a battered appearance. The front seat is covered with blood. Bullets have ploughed their way through everything. Many flying wires shot away. The throttle control out of action. The petrol tank punctured. We learn that a Fokker suddenly dived at them from a great height unawares. It passed right under them and then swung round, climbed and again attacked them in the rear. Lucas was shot after firing half a drum and Wright soon after in the right shoulder and lung. He had to glide down without his engine and land with his left hand. A great performance. Lucas died immediately after landing. Saw Wright in hospital today. Seems fairly cheerful. It is sad to have our partnership thus severed. The doctor says he will get well. He'd flown with him before, you see, so. But, you know, you can see that if there's only 16, 20 of you in a mess and you're getting one killed a day,
The situation improved gradually as the pendulum of aerial superiority began to swing back to the British as a new generation of aircraft that could compete on equal terms with the Fokker made their appearance. Now, the first to arrive was the FE-2B.
FE?
2B.
FE? I did
Farnborough Experimental.
Yes!
A two-seater pusher aircraft which could be regarded as a step forward from the near-obsolescent Vickers fighter.
Yeah, again, the gunner's perch and a front nacelle seat with a he's got a completely unobstructed forward view, and he's got a Lewis gun, which is on a pole. Later on, they have two, one pointing back as well. What are its limitations?
Well, although lacking in manoeuvrability and only capable of around 72 mile per hour at its service ceiling of about 9,000 feet. It was a sturdy and reliable aircraft.
It bloody was. I mean, in some ways, it's one of our favourites because it lasts through the whole war in one role after another. Night fighters by the end. Now, the first squadron equipped with them, the FE-2B, was 20 Squadron. That arrives in late January 16. And it's followed shortly after by 25 Squadron, 23 Squadron and 22 Squadron. So the FE-2B, that's a step forward, but is it superior to the Fokker?
Well, no, but the Fokker soon found that the ungainly-looking FE-2Bs were more than capable of looking after themselves.
What did Lieutenant Reynold, that's an unusual name.
Yeah, did
Reynold McFarlane, 25 Squadron, RFC, I'm expecting great things from this after my French one last week.
One fight in particular stands out in my mind. Just a tiny line in the sky, rushing at one with frightening speed, belching bullets which flick on one's wings as they strike on either side. It's hard to fly straight and level to give man, my Scottish Rice Balls observer, a good shot. And after a bit, I don't, sideslipping like hell. By the grace of goodness, the Hun misses our vital parts and either hit or scared of man's fire, dives off groundwards in a trail of smoke. Thus we survive, victors over the plummeting enemy going down, down into the cloud towards the dark earth. Was he hit or just buzzing off? But it has been a very near thing.
So there you are. They can look after themselves. If the Fokker makes a mistake, they'll shoot them down. The German tactics are beginning to evolve, and it's quite interesting. So they start to use decoys flying low down. So there'd be, say, a couple of decoy aeroplanes, fairly helpless looking, but hidden up in the clouds, possibly in the sun or behind some... clouds, or just not where you're expecting them. There'd be a squadron of Fokkers. The Fokkers.
And this is once more Lieutenant Ranald McFarlane. It was all a strange, otherworldly feeling. There, high above the battlefront, perhaps on a lovely, cold spring morning, peaceful seeming, and away on the distant ground, marvellously clear trails of smoke from enemy trains. Then far below, one spots a light grey shape moving between the clouds. An albatross or taube glides across the green-brown earth. One dives down to strafe it. The Boche pilot is alerted and dives away eastwards. But suddenly, there is an unpleasant crackling behind. The albatross has been a decoy, or it is being escorted and two or three nasty, spitting little monoplanes come whizzing in to attack. A fierce turn or two, but the odds are too great, and despite the known danger of diving away, one plunges earthwards like a stone to luckily live and fight again.
And we'll live and fight again in a couple of seconds while we have a couple of adverts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
The whole aggressive ethos inculcated by Trenchard meant that they could not just ignore any opportunity to shoot down an aircraft actively tormenting their comrades in the infantry below them. It was a difficult dilemma that every pilot had to resolve, balancing his sense of duty with the question of personal survival.
Yeah, and that's the problem, isn't it, with any decoy thing. So there you go. Now, other British aircraft are beginning to arrive to add weight to the British air offensive on the Somme. One of them is my all-time favourite name. What is that, Gary? You know I love this name. It's so romantic. It's so dramatic. It tells a story in the name.
The Sopwith 1.5 Strata, which I once referred to as the Sopwith 1.5-inch Strata. Now, that first appeared over the Somme with 70 Squadron and was the first British aircraft to mount a synchronised Vickers machine gun firing through the propeller. Well, not through the propeller, through the space between the propeller.
Now, it's originally built for the Royal Naval Air Service, but the RFC is desperately getting some. It's powered by 110 horsepower Clerget rotary engine, and it could get a decent speed up for the time, 99 miles per hour at 8,000 feet. And it took only 17 minutes to reach 10,000 feet. Compare that to the B2C.
It was 45 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, the Observer, he's also got a Lewis gun mounted on a ring mounting. Got mounties on the mind.
Now, the Sopwith 1.5 Strata thus generated considerable firepower, which made it a formidable opponent, even though it had severely limited manoeuvrability.
That's right. It's not the only one. There's another favourite of ours. I wonder if you can remember what this is. It's single-seater, scout or fighter. It's the DH2. What does DH stand for, Gary?
De Havilland.
You're a font of knowledge today.
Now, as you mentioned, it was a single-seater pusher fighter. That means that the engine is in the rear, of slightly comical appearance. And it perhaps, more than any other aircraft, was instrumental in winning domination of the Somme skies for the Royal Flying Corps.
Yeah, it's a fab little thing. It's not quite as fast as the Fokker. It's not quite got as good a rate of climb. But it's better than the German reconnaissance aircraft, their core out, and it could prey on them, and it can hold its own with the Fokker. And there's nothing better than holding your own with a Fokker.
Now, once the three new British aircraft types were fully operational, the swing of the aerial pendulum was at last reversed. But it was a slow process, and many more British pilots would die in outclassed aircraft before there were sufficient numbers of the new types to wrest control.
Now, I think we've made it clear what's important: artillery observation, photographic reconnaissance. But there's a cult of the ace. There's a cult of the scout pilot. And who epitomises this?
Well, one of great importance is Albert Ball.
Not Allenbaugh,
which you put in your book, I think. On the outbreak of war, he answered the call of adventure, and he enlisted in the ranks of the 2nd, 7th Battalion Sherwood Foresters.
Fine body of men.
On the 21st of September 1914.
He's a public school boy. He's the son of the Lord Mayor of Nottingham. He's immediately commissioned as second lieutenant. Of course, he's anxious to get to the front. He pays his own flying lessons, and he managed to get into the ever-expanding RFC. Pilot training follows up with them, and then he's posted out to France and joins 13th Squadron, flying which noble aircraft?
The B-2Cs.
Hooray! That's on the 18th of February 1916. There he's nothing special, really. He engages in the normal duties of a corps squadron pilot, but he actually does something that isn't normal. He takes every opportunity to fly the attached Bristol Scout. Now, the Bristol Scout we mentioned before, it's one of the first Scout airplanes. There are problems with it, but it's a fantastic airplane in some ways. And what happens to Ball?
Well, as a result, his potential may well have been recognised, because on the 7th of May, he was transferred to 11th Squadron, who were in the process of forming a flight of Bristol and Newport Scouts.
Now, the Newport Scouts we haven't really mentioned, but they're a French single-seater. They're a tractor airplane, and they're armed with a Lewis gun on the top wing. They could have done with a bigger machine gun, but their power was limited. But it's a great aircraft. Now, Ball, he's destined to great things. He is, and his name's linked with the Newport 16, isn't it? Let's have a bit more about the Newport. So, give me its stats. Newport 16. Come on, without looking it up in the book or in the notes, Gary.
The streamlined Newport 16 was powered by.
It's obvious you're reading it.
110. Oh, sorry. So it had a 110 horsepower Lerone engine, which managed to generate speeds of, listen to this, up to 110 mile per hour, with a service ceiling of 15,000 feet. Now, that means the Newport 16 was superior in every respect to the Fokker, with the sole exception of armament.
Yeah, well, this is what I mentioned. They've only got the one Lewis gun. And how many rounds in a Lewis gun drum, Gary?
49.
Nah, I'm sure
46.
It's 41.
Something like that.
43. This is the eternal question, which you'd think I'd know after 40 years. And now that Lewis gun's mounted on the centre, the top wing, and it's fired by a Bowden wire grip, which is fits to the joystick. So the joystick's giving even more joy.
Yeah, but once more, that's dodging the central requirement for a synchronised gun by directing its fire from, as you say, above the span of the propeller.
Top wing above, yeah, that's it, yeah. Now, what's he doing? He's a scout pilot, as they call him, with 11 Squadron. What's his job?
Well, it's his role to protect the slower and vulnerable reconnaissance machines whilst they trundled up and down above the battlefields, and to engage in offensive patrols to seek out and destroy German aircraft wherever they might be found.
Now, in May and June, so this has been going on for months. In May and June, the pace of the conflict, it gets more and more frenetic, doesn't it?
Yeah, because both sides are fighting desperately for control of the skies prior to the launch of the Allied offensive.
And you might say, well, isn't the offensive a secret? But you can see it coming, all the logistical preparations, all the camps. The Germans know what's coming, don't they? Now, so who's important in a squadron? Now, we haven't really talked about this, but it's a key part. Who do you think has a big role?
Well, you mean the squadron commander?
Yeah, I do.
They're crucial because they need to establish the state of morale for the whole squadron. They could provide the kind of personal inspiration that would carry their men joyously into combat. They could provide a secure backdrop of administrative competence, or they could undermine their men by inefficiency and a kind of carping, nitpicking and moaning that could destroy a squadron.
Are you thinking of that boss of yours that had very nice hair now?
No. Trenchard had banned all his squadron commanders from flying over the lines. The experience they had accumulated was just too valuable to lose.
Now, to me, that seems a sensible and pragmatic order. But I can also see that it might put some of the squadron, well, all of the squadron commanders, in a bit of an unenviable position. Why?
Well, because henceforth they had to order their men up into the hostile skies day after day in all but the roughest weather. Yet they couldn't share in the inevitable dangers as a combat pilot. Now, some had already built their reputation, so they could carry it off without much comment. And this is Major Lano Hawker, VC.
I think that might be a clue.
Of 24 Squadron. And you're going to tell us what he says.
Really, a squadron commander in the Flying Corps can be called a soft job as far as this war is concerned. Jolly good pay and no risk, except from overeating. But I suppose I can claim to have earned it. And it certainly carries its worries and responsibilities with it. It is rather hard sometimes to order people off on what is obviously a very risky job, but I have a great moral advantage in my little bit of ribbon. It comes better from me than from a squadron commander who was never a good flyer and perhaps has never seen active service conditions. Actually, nowadays, however, I am glad to say most squadron commanders are expert flyers and have seen quite their share of the mill. Even colonels know what they are talking about. It's only those higher up still, who unfortunately are chiefly responsible for sending machines out, have in any way lost touch or have never been in touch with modern conditions. It's quite common, isn't this? Well, I mean, isn't it common in every stage of almost every organisation? But what am I referring to?
Well, I think you're saying that, look, like Hawker, many of the aggrieved pilots actually looked higher in the structure of the RFC to find their targets in the senior officers.
Yeah, brigadiers, sometimes trenchards. It's just human nature. And, you know, you often complained about your bosses, and I was known to have the odd word. Not Bryn Hammond or Tony Richards. They were lovely.
Now, the 4th Brigade, Royal Flying Corps, commanded by Brigadier General E.B. Ashmore, was intended to cater to the aerial needs of the 4th Army.
So, who's in it?
Well, the Corps aircraft were provided by 3, 4, 9 and 15 squadrons, who together formed the 3rd Corps Wing, and the scouts were made up of 22 and 24 squadrons in 14th Army Wing, as well as number 1 Balloon Squadron that provided the kite balloons. Now, the 9th Headquarters Wing had also been moved into the Somme area, and that was namely the 21st, 27th, 60th and 70th Squadrons. Now, as required, elements of 1st Brigade, that's the 2nd and 10th Squadrons, 2nd Brigade, 2nd and 16th Squadrons, and 3rd Brigade, 8th, 12th and 13th Squadrons, were made available to assist in the bombing offensive designed to paralyse the German railway system.
I think you need to have a lie down after that. That was brilliant, Gary. You didn't make any mistakes. Now, in total, I'll probably now go completely wrong. The RFC had concentrated some 185 aircraft in the Somme area, plus the outside aircraft from the other wings and all whatnots. Of these, some 76 76 of the 185 were the new Scout aircraft. Now, the French, they're there as well, aren't they? They've also concentrated considerable aircraft for the offensive. Because we've got to remember, the French are attacking on the Somme as well, despite Verdun. Now, to face that, I'm not going to give any statistics to that because I don't want to. Also, I haven't written it down.
To face this aerial armada, the Germans could only deploy some 129 aircraft, of which only a meagre 19 were scouts.
Is 19 less than 76?
Now, as the British concentrated all their resources for the offensive, the Germans were hampered by their equally onerous commitments battling the French air service over Verdun.
Of course.
And the Allies had achieved a significant aerial superiority over the Somme area.
Can I ask you a question? What's the purpose and point of the kite balloons?
Well, the British kite balloons complemented the services provided by the aircraft. They got a lot of disadvantages in that they had many advantages. They've got some disadvantages.
We'll come to... Which are you going to do first, Gary?
I'm going to do the advantages. They could remain aloft all day and all night, and the observers were not distracted by the responsibilities of flying an aircraft, and they had near-perfect communication with the ground by telephones. Now, this meant if the German batteries suspended fire for fear of discovery, as they often did when aircraft passed by, then they would be most permanently out of action or perforce reveal their locations when they opened fire.
Yeah, so because the balloons are always there. They're just there. So,
Now, in general, the balloons were best at reporting the overall situation and locating German batteries firing, but aircraft were far better at ranging the guns directly onto their targets.
Well, yeah, because they're more likely to be above it. Yeah, you can see why that would help with the clock code and things. Now, so let's move on. So the intensity of the conflict, it's ratcheting up, isn't it? Like a ratchet. You know, like a ratchet. And it seemed, but for a while it seems like the Germans are never going to break. Those Germans.
Then on the 18th of July, there occurred an event that marked the end of the supremacy of the Fokker and the beginning of a period of British hegemony above the trenches.
Hegemony.
And this is Major Robert Cherry of the, I'm not going to make any silly jokes, of 25 Squadron.
I was lost for a word there.
At about 9 p.m, whilst on patrol duty over Loos, three Fokkers were seen behind the lines. Lieutenant McCubbin proceeded over the lines towards them. One Fokker dived away from the other two and left them. The remaining two made for Lens towards another FE, that's a Farnborough experimental. Lieutenant McCubbin followed them. Whilst one of them was attacking the FE, piloted by Second Lieutenant Savage, both machines diving steeply. Lieutenant McCubbin dived towards the attacking machine and fired upon it. Immediately, the Fokker turned to the right from the other FE and dived perpendicularly towards the ground. It was seen to crash by 22 anti-aircraft battery. The second Fokker was either above or directly behind Lieutenant McCubbin's machine. After he turned, he saw neither the FE nor the two Fokkers.
Now, that crashed Fokker was piloted by none other than the Eagle of Lille. That's Lieutenant Max Immelmann. The Germans say that he wasn't shot down. He shot his own propeller off. The interrupter gear failed or synchronised gun. I've no idea whether that's true or not. That's what the Germans say.
But either way, the loss of their inspirational leader was a severe blow to the German air service. And, of course, in particular, to the other Fokker pilots.
So what are they going to do?
Well, to try and guard against any further such disaster, Kaiser Wilhelm intervened in person to remove his other champion, who was
Lieutenant Oswald Bulker.
Yeah, and he was going to be placed in relative safety by sending him on an inspection tour of the Balkan states and Turkey.
That's just getting him out of the way. But that puts him to safety, but it means that the other great German pilot on the Western Front was gone, and it leaves advantage to the British, and the Fokker menace begins to splutter out ignominiously.
And this is Second Lieutenant Gwilym Lewis of 32 Squadron.
If a Hun sees a DH2, he runs for his life. They won't come near them. It was only yesterday that one of the fellows came across a Fokker. The Fokker dived, followed by the DH2, but the wretched Fokker dived so hard that when he tried to pull his machine out, his elevator broke and he dived into our lines. Not a shot was fired. And he's definitely referring to Fokkers in both senses there.
Now, Lano Hawker, who was in command of 24 Squadron, he'd developed his tactical thinking to a peak of sophistication that encapsulated his personality and the ethos of the RFC. Now, we've heard this before, but it's worth hearing again.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what the tactical orders were?
Well, shall I read them in full?
Please, we've got time.
Have we? Yeah. What time is it?
We'll make time.
Right. Tactical orders by Officer Commanding Number 24 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps. Attack! Everything.
Excellent.
Lano Hawker.
Now, the artillery orders for the preliminary bombardment called for a 6-day concentrated barrage along the 25,000-yard front.
Now, that's divided into stages. First 2 days, wire cutting and registration of targets. Next 3 days, these targets have been pounded into destruction. And finally, on Z day, the guns would provide the supporting bombardment as the troops went over the top. They've got the plan is that they're going to erase, and I mean erase, this is not suppression, this is erasing. trenches and strong points are going to be erased. Observation posts and command headquarters, they're going to be put out of action. They've got something else, something important, but not quite so well done.
Well, counter-battery work was to remove the threat of the German guns. Any identified rest billets that the long-range guns could reach were also to be harassed. Lines of communications to and from the frontline area were to be disrupted every night.
That's by bombers, isn't it?
And finally, the wire-cutting programme would continue unabated.
That's a lot to do, isn't it? Now, to carry out this ambitious programme, there were 1,537 guns and howitzers. And that's one field gun for every 21 yards of the front. and one heavy piece for a gun for every 57 yards. Now, you wanted to make a point here.
Well, you already made it in the first
make
podcast.
Make it again. I'm magnanimous in victory.
Well, at Neuve-Chapelle, there were 530 guns, and that worked out, because of the size of the frontage, to one per 6 yards.
Yeah, and that's just really essentially one line there, but this is three trench
systems. It's a system.
Three trench systems, of which two are fully formed, and each one of them has three lines and also redoubts. So it's nowhere near as big a hurricane bombardment as Neuve-Chapelle, is it?
No. And as the batteries moved into the gun line, positions had to be dug, secure observation posts prepared in the front line, thousands of miles of telephone wire had to be laid, and 3 million shells brought up ready for the guns.
Hard work. You see, the trouble is, it seemed such a concentration of artillery power that people hadn't actually worked out it was less than Neuve-Chapelle or the rest of it, and it seemed like it couldn't fail. But Haig has extended the first day objectives. He includes the second line. That doubles the amount of trenches for the amount of shells falling. But there's other problems.
Well, we've mentioned this before. Most of the guns didn't have the range to reach the second line, and direct observation was inevitably made more difficult by their location on the reverse slopes.
So the end result is, and this is a criticism of Haig, the number and weight of shells falling on the German front line system was reduced. And what does that mean?
Well, it means the chances of outright failure were correspondingly increased.
Yeah, that's just... there's one thing I alluded to it briefly. There's one aspect of the artillery program that is neglected, in my view. What's that?
Well, the intensive nature of the artillery program also meant that although the importance of counter-battery work had been mentioned in the orders, it had unwittingly slipped down the priority lists of the hard-pressed gunners.
Yeah. They didn't put enough guns onto it, there was no recognition at the time of the immense number of shells that would be required to put just one German battery out of action. And remember, they don't have the gas shells. They don't have the things from later in the war. Oh, well. Now, what does this artillery programme mean for the Royal Flying Corps?
Well, it means that their core machines are in the air for hours on end. And on the 25th of June, it was planned to launch simultaneous coordinated attacks on every German observation balloon all along the British front.
And this is again, anything the Germans can do, we can do, the Germans can do. So they also have kite balloons up. Now, they've got to put out these eyes in the sky, haven't they?
Yeah, particularly during the vital last phase before the offensive begins. And Lieutenant Albert Ball, he takes part in the attacks. And I'm going to tell you what Second Lieutenant Albert Ball of 11 Squadron says.
I want to be Albert
Ball. Oh, it was rotten. For I only just got back. Three of us were sent from this squadron. The first time we did no good. So I asked for another chance. We all set out again. I went for my balloon and set it on fire, but my engine was badly hit and I had to come back all the 8 miles over Hunland at half speed and only a few feet up. My machine was hit badly. I've enclosed one of the bullets. This bullet went through my induction pipe, engine bearer plate and 3 inches of wood. Not so bad, is it? The other chaps were not very successful. One crashed his machine and the other did no good. The other 4 balloons were brought down by other squadrons. 5 were brought down by the RFC. About 100 machines went up for different balloons, so I think 5 is quite a good average for such a rotten job. You see, we had to get so low.
Yeah, and the Germans knew they were coming round, so they'd got loads of defences around the guns. Yeah. 28th of June, we're getting near, aren't we? The weather. God's definitely, God mittens, God's with us. God's on the German side, clearly. So there was thick mist enveloping the whole of the Somme Valley. And then, to make matters worse, heavy, showery rain from low cloud. What sort of weather would you describe this as?
Bad, certainly for flying and observation. And it severely hampered the artillery observation of the RFC. Although the artillery doubled their rate of fire in an effort to compensate, this was still a setback.
Yeah, every hour that's lost is a tremendous boost to the German cause. And due to the bad weather and a bit of general uncertainty as to how the bombardment's going in view of the lack of observation, it was decided to add two extra days to the preliminary bombardment, which meant the big assault would go in on what day, Gary?
The 1st of July.
We've heard of that date.
During the last days of June, interdiction bombing raids were carried... were stepped up in Scowl to hit at the rear area. Sorry, I got distracted. I was so pleased that I got interdiction right. I'll start again. During the last days of June, interdiction bombing raids were stepped up in Scowl to hit at the rear areas that even the longest range guns couldn't reach. Now, as usual, many of the raids were directed against the railheads in an attempt to delay and disrupt the inevitable movement forward of the German reserve divisions once the battle had commenced in earnest. Now, unfortunately, the weather conditions were not conducive to success.
No, bad visibility doesn't help bombing, does it? Now, what's happening to the scout pilots? Well, let's have a look at a Newport scout pilot, Alan Ball. Alan Ball. Albert Ball. He is not the squeaky-voiced midfielder, is he? The Newport scout pilots, they've got both offensive patrols, escort work, they've got everything. And what impact would this have? Well, the impact was a lot of stress, and it's unremitting. And although Ball had recently been on leave, he had two names.
Albert Ball began to show the strain in his letters home to his family, and I'm once more going to tell you what Second Lieutenant Albert Ball of 11 Squadron
this
says.
This has been a triumph of professionalism from start to finish.
The three Newport machines stand from 2:30 a.m. until 9:30 at night. So you bet we're getting a rotten time just now. However, things are looking good just now, so we might all help and keep things going at any cost. But it's a long day, and I'm afraid that if it lasts very long, a few of the chaps will be going sick. I'm okay, but oh, so fagged. However, I shall soon get over that.
Now, let's sum it up a bit. So this is the aerial offensive getting ready for the 1st of July. What do we feel about it, Gary?
Well, during the period of preparation, the Royal Flying Corps had been successful in securing both a numerical and qualitative superiority over the disputed battlefield. The RFC had struggled in the early stages of the aerial preparations, but the arrival of the new generation of aircraft, coupled with the determination to follow a cold-blooded aggressive air strategy, had left them ready to reap the fruits of aerial supremacy at the very moment it most mattered, when the offensive was finally launched.
Now, it's fair to say that hard-pressed staff officers, generals, they'd always want more, wouldn't they? But in truth, they had all the photographs they could reasonably expect of the German trenches, reserve lines and strong points. Some of the German batteries had been engaged and their position registered. The German reserve troops had been harassed by the bombing of their billets, although that's mainly loss of sleep. Don't take this as being slaughtered in their billets. And the crucial railroads that you just mentioned, the interdiction routes, raids had been disrupted, would be generous, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the later stages... No German aircraft had been able to cross the British front line to expose the details of the offensive preparations to the German higher command. So all in all, Trenchard could be proud of his men.
So it's all going to go well on the 1st of July, you reckon?
What could possibly go wrong?
What indeed? Well, compared to our podcast.
Yes. Maybe taking a break's done us...
Power of good.
Power of good, yeah.
Cheers, Gary.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?